Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 1st, 1998. In the fireside room this morning, we have Walter Rangwin Jr. Session number is 98-3, and it's titled Spirituality and Story, Hospitality Part 3, Talk. Let's listen in.
The category for it, I put down as Spirituality and Story. Let me take a step backward and then forward to that. With regard to hospitality, I identified five elements that I thought of as pretexts, if you will, for talking about many things in hospitality. Five elements that it seems to me are fairly significant to the act itself, when people host strangers or enemies so that they become guests. I've said it several times over here, and I may yet repeat it, that hospitality itself, it seems to me, is not a static issue, it's a dramatic one. It moves, and as it moves forward, the roles change and relationships develop. They may be brief. You may stop by as a stranger and be taken in and fed and clothed and given a bed for the night, and then the next day you may go on. It may be brief. But if it all works well, and if it all works under the holy aegis of God, you don't go away the same as when you came, and those who hosted you do not speak a farewell the same as when they said welcome. On the other hand, hospitality can be a longer process, as we see in the Old Testament, when we realize that the sojourners or the aliens among them were not just there for a little while, but for longer periods of time. And then some of these aliens, Ruth, actually joined Rahab, the family, and so the next step becomes membership, entering into the family itself. There's, you know, I said Ruth, and just right away it struck me, there's a remarkable ode by John Keats in which he just touches Ruth. He just touches her, and I think it's in the Ode to Autumn, I'm not sure. The line is in my mind, but which one? Where it says that the woman stood among the alien corn. And she stood among the alien corn. And in my mind, I suddenly see Ruth exactly as that painting, which is in the Chicago Institute. And if I think hard, maybe someone will tell me. It's called The Song of the Lark. And it's a picture, actually, of... I should never start these things without thinking them through. There is a woman. It's a picture of who's the martyred woman, the remarkable fighting woman. Yeah, Joan of Arc. It's a picture of Joan of Arc standing among alien corn almost, and she pauses. She has a scythe in one hand, and she's pausing. You can scarcely see the lark up there. But the whole rapt expression on her face, pausing in the harvest or whatever, reminds me of Ruth somehow, and that line, standing among the alien corn. All of which is only tangential. Anyway, so the five elements that I'm talking about, or I'll talk about four of them, one is the attitude or the source, the spiritual source for our acts of hospitality. The second one, which I spoke about yesterday, is room, the spaciousness or the space, the room in which we invite people. And I drew upon Old Testament word and a New Testament one. You'll see, by the way, that much of my method this week will be somewhat linguistic. I'm going to skip food. That was the third that I had. I'm going to talk, as you can see today. And tomorrow I'll talk about ministry, service, those five things. Now, to what I began before, I've been calling this spirituality and story, partly because I needed to pick a topic. The fellow who does the tape came and he put down in front of me a list of topics. Which one of these are you talking about or underneath? And so I took spirituality. I suppose it could be ethic, but I like the spiritual development that takes place in the act, in the ethical and ritual act of hospitality. So I did that. And I said I would talk a little bit about story today underneath this whole issue of talking, and I will. To those of you who have not been here before, I repeat over and over again that pretty much when I do use story or when I'm talking about all these elements, I don't intend for you to think I'm being comprehensive. I am, as it were, glancing at these elements and hoping that as I glance and share with you some of the experiences that surround them, you yourselves may develop more and more an understanding of finally how hospitality is not a singular act alone by itself, but it bleeds into and it accepts so many of our different holy acts, even our acts of sacrament. You'll see that I talked a bit about baptism today. Let me start this way. We have, since March, a grandson, Van and I. It's our very first grandchild. And those of you who have grandchildren maybe understand what I'm saying. How lovely that is. But I think about this bringing of a child, not just into the world, but into a hospitable space, into a family, and then also into this communion, which is bounded one to another in Jesus Christ. Then I think also of the kind of talk that we do, some of it very ritualized. We use the talk of the church, which carries so much more weight than our brains are able to understand, so that sometimes we simply utter these right and proper words to one another and recognize that it's God who fills them up with substance and holiness. And I got to baptize this child, Noah Martin. The boy's name is Noah Martin. And this is May. What is today? July. So it's just about a month and a half ago. This is how close this is. Very moving for me. Noah Martin's mother is Mary and father is John. We really know how to think of names. Yeah, and Mary is our daughter. And before the weekend of the baptism, she came and I saw the child for the first time probably on Tuesday. Oh, I know why God makes children the way they come out, smelling so good and so touchable, so eminently touchable. You can't keep your hands off kids. There's something about that flesh, isn't it? That little sausage arm. You want to touch it several ways. You want to use the ends of your fingers to touch it. You want to squeeze a little bit. You want to use the back of your hand, because that's a different kind of a touch. I want to use this ridge of my forelip, which I'm sorry, I usually do clip and shave, but I've been gone from home for 2 weeks. But I want to use the ridge of my lip just to brush over that and feel those tiny little baby hairs, that soft little baby hair, that hirsute suit that they wear when they first come into the world. And I want to smell the smells, which is something else that's completely inviting. And I think God does that for several reasons. I think children come like that because you know that when you touch them, they're feeling two things at once. They're making discovery. Not only when you touch them do they feel your hand or your cheek or the hug around their body, or you know, whatever tickling you do when you change their diapers and fool around and all that sort of stuff, but they're also feeling themselves. It's an idea that Martin Buber unpacks in I and Thou a little bit, and perhaps you've thought about that. They're also feeling themselves. So you take the back of your hand and you brush it over that little chubby cheek, that little round chubby cheek. And you can imagine that for the child in that particular moment, the joining, this act of relationship is not only the discovery of one there who grants whatever this mercy is without a name, but also a discovering of cheek. Oh yeah, cheek. Mm-hmm. You know, you put your arms around, they begin to feel the shape and the position of their bodies. Buber says that they reach that trembling hand out to the universe and they touch something, and then they realize both the hand and the universe, which to me is just remarkable. I had surgery several years ago. I had a portion of my lung removed, and I was in intensive care for a relatively long period because I was what they called a bleeder. I mean, I didn't know about this, the poor fan did, that they had to take me back in. So I was sort of out of it for a long time, but I do remember the discovery of myself. This is why I know what I'm talking about. I was in intensive care and scarcely knowing what I was doing. I have a vague memory that at one time I said to Than when she came in, I said, "You tell them, Than. You tell them." And Than says that I was just really trembling with anger. "You tell them I'm not their honey." Which is exactly what Than did. She laughed, and oh, that just upset me so much. No, you tell them I am not their honey. These nurses who kept calling me honey, I don't know why that bothered me so much. Only there came a moment, you know, that in the darkness of surgery and in in various darknesses you don't even know it's dark. It's a not being. It's a sort of absence, not just of consciousness, but of being in some of these darknesses, so that when you go back and try to remember, as when you sleep, of course, you have a sort of sense of time, the passage of time. You have some sense of it a little bit. We're used to that. But when you're in some of these darknesses, such as the darkness of despair, you don't even know it's dark. You scarcely even know that you're there. Until at one point, I remember, and I had my hands and arms were on boards, but I remember a stroke on the back of my arm here. And that's the first thing that declared me into me. It did it by my right arm. And it was Stan's hand. And she was granting me, don't you understand, being. What a gesture. She was calling me into consciousness, but she was declaring, yeah, this is your arm. And with what mercy I present you with your own arm. Now, she didn't know that. Can you imagine what baptism is? I mean, all the touchings that we do of baby children is one thing. But that washing, which is like the flood being an example of this, in which 8 people were saved. I like the way that happens. Peter doesn't say, look at all those who are drowned. He says, in which 8 people were saved. Noah, Martin. I saw him on Tuesday, and on Wednesday I couldn't stand it. Thursday I went out and I bought a tree. I bought a good-sized flaming maple tree, scarlet maple, 2 inches round at the trunk, and therefore I stood there while they dug it out of the ground. I went to a very good nursery where it was in the ground. They dug it out and I watched. And I watched while they bagged it. I helped them actually bag that root ball. And then we carried it to my truck. I have sort of a small farm, truck farm, and we carried it to my truck with the root ball in first. And then we actually wrapped the leaves because I had to drive about 6-7 miles, and you don't want the wind to tear those poor leaves off or dry them out too much. And so we baptized it in a certain sense. We sprayed the wrapping, you know, which was all burlap. We sprayed that to try to keep that on there. It took several hours for me to get the tree itself. And then I drove it home, and I backed my truck into the field, the very center of one of our fields. We have about 17 acres, and I dug a hole in the ground, which took another, I don't know how many hours. It has to be a big hole. And I learned how to do that. You take the sod and put it to the side, and then you dig the good earth up, and then you get down to that clay, and you just keep on digging. Time comes to fill it in. The first thing you do is take that sod and put it on first, upside down. You put in branches, you put in any kind of thing that will finally rot, but at first allows a kind of a drainage. Then you put the clays, then you put that ball in, then you have to work around it until you build it up. And I got mulch. It took me the whole day to put that tree in. A whole day. And then came Friday, in which, incidentally, my other daughter, Talitha, had her wedding rehearsal, and then came Saturday, in which, incidentally, we married the child off. This is a busy weekend. Can you imagine? I'm telling you with all my heart, truly, that for Than and me, this was like flowers. This was like fruit. This was like all our years of parenting has come to some kind of goodness. And it's goodness beyond talking about. The only thing you can do with such goodness is just eat it. Peel it and eat it. I could hardly stand, although I did not cry at the wedding. No, I didn't. I amazed myself. I walked her down. I walked her down like that, and I handed her arm to Raymond Washington. This is Talitha. One day I'll tell you about her. I mean, the fact that she took an arm is amazing. The fact that she allowed me to walk her down, then I skittered around like that, and I popped up as the preacher. Yeah, but I'm not talking about that. I'm not even going to mention that 5 minutes before we did the processional, we discovered that the rings for the women, for Talitha, were back home. I won't go. It was the next day. It was Sunday. It was Sunday morning that we set the basin up in our living room. A very big basin. I got a big sloppy basin. Wide, not deep. Wide. So it could be like, you know, like that sea of water, that grass sea. And so we could see the splash in the water and all that sort of stuff. And then and then we had a gathering of many, many people, and we talked about the child. I talked to the sponsors and said, look, do you know what you're promising? And do you know who you're promising it to? Not to the parents, you're promising it to this child. I talked to the parents. We chit-chatted and talked, and we kept telling them, well, this is Noah's day. This is Noah's name day. This is the day Noah is to receive a name that Noah shall never lose. Ritual talking, and then my my declaration of the name of this child came with a dramatic, you understand I'm talking about hospitality, don't you? You understand I'm talking about the washing of the guest who is a stranger, who is discovering, in this case, himself, as we discover that self, and we together confer a name upon this child, and the name is Child of God. That's the secret name. That's the deep name, Child of God, which has been in association with washings and water crossings all the way back to Israel when they were called out of Egypt. And they, as St. Paul suggests, wherever I wrote that down, 1 Corinthians 1, was a baptism. I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit. And you remember that I talked, some of you remember I talked about the sounds of grace? Well, they remain our friends, and a bunch of them came up for that. So we are party colored. I live in a place that's not party colored, and it always creates a great deal of discussion when my friends come. I mean, they're African American. And when we were done with that, I took the bowl, which you have to walk with very carefully. When you have a wide bowl, it's like carrying your soul in something, you know. And if you shake it too much, it'll slop out. So you go very carefully, and we made a procession from the back of our house all the way out into that field. And doggone it, those people from the Sounds of Grace, they started singing. Ooh, I about dropped one. They started singing. And it was, and what they sang is what we always sang before a concert. It's, I love you, Lord. And I lift, you know, that my voice to worship you, oh my soul, rejoice. Take joy, my King, in what you give. Let it be a sweet, sweet sound. The sun was shining and the sky was high blue, and there was that flaming tree in the middle of the field, and Than held the baby, and I said, Than, stand in the shadow of that tree. And she did, and we prayed and we sang, and I took the water and I poured it around the tree itself. And so we have a Noah tree. Every one of our grandchildren is going to have a tree. This is an African custom translated to America. This is a custom, particularly in the Deep South, that they would do when the little babies were born. They would plant trees and name them for the baby. And what they had in mind was a spiritual association, so that wherever that child was sold hereafter, yet but here was the tree. Here was the tree. And then I had written a poem for her. I didn't read it at that point, but when we got back to the house, I read it. So this is very new. You don't mind if there are mistakes, I hope, but I thought I would read it to you. All of which is naming. I hope you understand. Well, anyway. Here it goes. I'm calling it for now, Water, Come Down. Come down today. I am the sun. I am fire and light. I am the first one at the end of the night who heard of your naming day. God told me to whisper the news to my sister. Child will be named today. I am the cloud, high, white, and proud, or black and flashing, roaring out loud. I never could hide my mood. So on the day when the sun came by to whisper that you were to be baptized, to be washed in the fire of God, to shine with the light of God, I laughed. Oh, child, I laughed till I cried, till the tears of rejoicing ran down from my eyes. Thunder, I thundered out loud for that kid who was loved by a cloud. I am the rain coming down from heaven. One drop, 10 drops, 10,000,007. Down, down to water the ground to make the good grain grow. But on the day when you were baptized, I rolled the wind to the edge of the skies and called the sun, sun, shine on me for the child below so the child can see a flaming raining bow. So, after the rainstorm, dear child of mine, whenever you see it, that rainbow's a sign that God is with you and God is kind. He'll never let you go. I am the wind. I blow the rain like bullets against your window pane, or carry it down in a misty shower to rinse the trees and wash the flowers. No one can see me, but I am the power, the breath, and the spirit of God. That day when the sun told the cloud about you, and the cloud told the rain, and the rain told me too, I wanted to wash you clean and good. I wanted to blow that water to you fast as I could. But I, the earth, was crying. I'm thirsty. I'm about to die. The ground so cracked, the land so dry. Oh, child, the water that fell from the sky was sucked into that ground. Gone. Gone, and how could you be baptized when no water was left to be found? I am the ground the rain fell on the day you were baptized. I drank it, child. I drank it down. Should I apologize? But I am the soil where the seed is sown. And first, before that seed can grow, down in the darkness, down below, that little seed must die. The rain makes it rise again. It's the water that gives it life. So the seed and I, both moist and green, from out of ourselves, we sent a stream of water purified for you to be baptized. I am the water that came from God, from the love of the sun and his sister, the cloud, the water that filled the skies. I am the water of colors, for we, the rain and the sun and the wind and me, made a bow at the edge of the skies. I am the water went underground to turn the whole world upside down, to bring the dead to life. And I am the water that flows in a river, the river of life forever and ever. Yes, I am the water came down to your town to find you, child, and you I found the day you were baptized. I was the water that washed you in, your head, your heart, your soul, your skin, clean of the devil, clean from sin, the day you were baptized. Your family was there that holy day. They heard the good baptizer say, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Spirit, three in one, I baptize you, dear child. I am the water that fell on you three times with the word that made you new, while everyone smiled and smiled. Upon your forehead, the cross of Christ, and in your hand, the light of God's light. O child of earth and skies, burning as bright as the angels at night, you are God's love and God's loveliest sight on the day you were baptized. All of us now, on earth and in heaven, one mouth, 10 mouths, 10,000,007, greet you, friend. We're glad you came. So glad we stand and applaud. And we call you by your brand new name, beautiful, beautiful child of flame. You are the child of God. Well, how can you help it, huh? I mean, you get into that, you see that you've got to talk. No, I have to talk. I have to talk about what's taking place. Let me go some very, very quickly and touch some issues that I can't spend much time on, but lay it before you. Naming. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and the earth was without form. And even if it had a form, it was empty. It's like saying the earth, if it were a cup, it was empty, but there wasn't even a cup there. Is this mine? Did you have one here? You did, okay.
It's not mine, it's yours.
It's mine? Thank you. But you get it. You understand what I'm saying. It's a Hebrew concrete way of saying nothing. No form, and even the form would have been void, empty. And, of course, the Spirit of God was moving upon the face of the water. And God said, this is such hospitality, because the speaking creates the guest. And God said, let there be light. And you must know, I'll swiftly go by this, that when God created things according to the account in the first and second chapters of Genesis, God spoke two different kinds of language. The first kind of language, in the Hebrew mind, you must almost be like children if you want to visualize what they had in mind. There was not a distinction between the word and the thing. This is how important an understanding of language is to the Hebrew. The word was the thing. You understand? So what they would say, if you want to visualize God making light, it wasn't as if God made a command and said, light, come forth, and then light on its own obeyed the command and come forth. That's two things. That's not one thing. There's a command and there's a response. Nor is it, in the American and Western European sense, like a mechanical creating. First, there's a blueprint, you know. All right, let there be light. And it's like God has somehow or other defined blueprint and then creates the light. No. It's like this. It's as if you could see the marvelous yawp of God open up. And maybe you didn't hear the word, let there be light, but you could see it because the word and the light were the same. Flooding out of God's mouth is light. That's the kind of language we cannot speak. We cannot speak. C.S. Lewis says, if ever we try to create something out of nothing, we will create monsters. We will create monstrosities. We'll talk about that at some length. And I know when I first began to be a writer, I kept wishing to write the thing that had never been written before. Oh, I had that desire. And I begin to recognize now that there is something potentially sinful in how one pursues such a desire as that. I wanted to speak the word that had never been spoken before. But I can't. That's why I tell you it's one thing, God's word. Let there be a firmament. And I can't do this anymore, but it's as if the word firmament was the firmament issuing out of the presence of God, issuing out of the mind and the soul and the affection and the love and the control and the glory of God. That's not what we can do. It wasn't given unto us to do. That's not the language we use, but you're already ahead of me. When God had created the light, next God named it. Named the light day. And see, when you have light, then of course suddenly you realize there is darkness. Oh, which is a good realization, because the dark that you know is dark is not going to kill you or take your being away. So the darkness is named night, and you can go on from that point. This is what God gives us to do. That's a little bit about what God gave Adam and Eve, that is humanity, to name. To name the animals, it's a very scientific kind of thing to do. To name the animals, and then to name one another. Eve, at having children, names them. And this is not some sly, silly kind of association. This is not a referent. My name is Walter. And in our analytic kind of thought, we think of these things merely as reference. We make the sounds, but the sounds are only to call into your mind the memory of something else somewhere, or to call me. You understand? I say tree. Nobody thinks there's a tree in here. And yet, nevertheless, most primitive peoples, and certainly the Middle Eastern peoples, in the Hebrew, when you say tree, in Old English, the word tree is treo, T-R-E-O-W, treo, which is almost the same word in Old English as truth. And there is an association there between these things. You have to think about the culture itself. But to say tree is somehow or other, forget this language, it's always a bit unright, to access treeness here. That treeness is here in speaking it. So constantly we're dancing with the things we talk about. When we talk about them, we are always in relationship to them. And why, what it means that we have, what we have is this privilege to order the earth, watch over it, dress, till, and keep it, means we also can name things. We can do what God did. Gerhard von Rott, in his commentary on Genesis, is where I get what I'm about to tell you. Von Rott says that when God named things, and by association, when we name things properly and with health and holiness, it's not just the attachment of a sound, Noah. It really is the accomplishment of three things. Now, this is Western for me to do that for you, but, we're Lutheran. And you want to take a note. And as soon as I say three things, everybody's happy. Oh, yeah, okay, one. Now we can see the future, right? And that's order. We're going to get all the way to three. Well, if I can go quickly through these, the naming of something looks like the creating of it, though it isn't. Because when you discover the name of something and utter it, what you are doing, whether you're parents or artists or lovers one of another giving names, what's happening is you're bringing that thing which was not or could not be known but existed. It existed where it might not be known. You're bringing it into the realm of knowledge. Now it may be apprehended because now we have a name to call it. Do you understand? So that when we name things, in effect, what we're doing, it looks like creating. I write a story. Somebody else reads that story, they say, well, you know what? I've always known that, but I didn't know how to say that before. The whole story becomes the name of something. That's what art does. That's what we do. That's what music does. Music names things ineffably. And if you know anything, ineffably means that it's unspeakable. Greek word, in and no words for it. Can't speak it. Okay, so that's the first thing that takes place. By the way, let me just stick this in. You don't think I'm going to get through that board, do you? Here I am. Here we go. So maybe what we'll do. Carry this on tomorrow. Anyway, think about sin now. I mean, let's just stick this in very, very quickly. But if people name a false name, if people bear a false witness, and that's the name that goes forth into society and is used for this individual, though it is not that individual's true name, what do you think happens? It's horrible. The truth of that individual is pressed down into that realm where it may not be known or apprehended or stood in relationship with. And some false. This is what bigotry does. These are what silly names that we have for people we think know very well. I mean, when the oppressor speaks about the oppressed, very often the oppressor comforts him or herself by believing that they understand the oppressed very, very well, and that that in fact they're doing right and well by them. But in fact what they're doing is they're imposing their understanding upon the oppressed. And by doing that, they're hiding what is the true name of the oppressed. That's what's so horrible about nigger. That's what's so horrible about some of the names we foisted upon women. And usually those who are in charge think that they know better, and they have kind hearts. They have no trouble really, truly, honestly believing they have kind hearts. That's why it's so damn difficult for those of us, and I include myself there, who are involved in some kind of prejudice, even to recognize that it exists. But look at the consequence. I can't find her whose name I will not wait to learn. No one can if I'm in charge. Okay, and you can do that. The second thing that happens when God names, and you can notice this, by the way, in the relationship between day and night, the relationship between the sky, heavens, and the earth, the relationship between earth and seas, is that God establishes relationship between the newly named thing and every other thing named. It's a grammar, if you understand what I'm saying. It's a grammar of creation. In Hebrew, it's a grammar, which, by the way, is when you invite a guest in, sometimes you ask that guest merely to talk. Talk about your day, guest, talk about it. And when the guest talks, the guest is taking this wild and inchoate day, and by having to put it into a grammar, by having to put it into a language, nouns and verbs and so forth, is beginning to seek associations and order for that day. That's why when you get home and someone you love comes forward, you say, oh, I got to tell you what happened today. And I got to tell you right now, because if I don't tell you right now, I won't be able to eat supper. And in the telling now, the confusion and the chaos of that day begins to take some order and some meaning. Because it is, our grammar is that. It's how we order the universe. Think about that. Think about that. The third thing that happens when we or God name is that there is a purpose, a value declared for that one. Skip down very quickly, let's say, to the naming of Jacob as Israel. When Jacob is named as Israel, literally what happens is Israel, Israel, is given a purpose for being, not just a declaration of who he is now and who therefore the people after Jacob, Israel, will be, but also of what they will do. Wrestler with God, struggler with God, little pun. On the one hand, you've been fighting God all along. You did, on the other hand, fight on the side of God, fight by the side of God. And that gets all unpacked in the baptism, as Paul talks about Israel crossing the Red Sea, he sees that as a baptismal thing and a naming kind of thing. And from that point on, they are my chosen people. They are a priesthood. And a priest, in this Old Testament sense, got a job to do. And the job is to associate God to the people. All the people, that's what Israel was. The priest for the world, so that they would appeal. I mean, their very being somehow or other was to bear the business and the stuff of the world to God, ultimately, although they at that point were not aware that this was only one God. Well, so the same thing with Jacob, who becomes Israel. His person changes. He's no longer the usurper, the trickster, Yaakov. He's no longer pulling tricks on his brother so that his brother wants to kill him. Now he meets his brother bowing down, and it seems a genuine act. It certainly is a hospitable thing. It certainly is the normal thing to do as you approach someone who you honor. But, you know, he thought Esau would kill him. And now he falls upon Esau's neck and weeps. The name brings... You got it?
Good.
And so in baptism, Paul talks about Israel crossing that sea and receiving then a... It's being, those who were slaves and who therefore were not. Well, and you know, I hope all of you are thinking in your mind about 1 Peter chapter 2, 9 and 10. It's the same thing that Peter says to the church Catholic, to wherever this letter is going, generally. Once you were no people, once you didn't exist, once nobody had stroked your cheek or your arm, you didn't even know. It's the darkness you didn't know. Once you were, and now you see why I'm using the word darkness. Once you were no people, now you are God's people. Now you are chosen, that's your name, and you have a purpose. You are a royal priesthood. And if you don't understand what that means, let me tell you what that means. That you are to declare the wonderful works of your God who brought you out of darkness into this holy, beaming, marvelous light. Everything I've said, I've just wound up into a neat little ball for you. Get the take. And that's what happens when we name one another, honestly. Did I say something?
Get the take.
Yeah, I mean, in case I went by too fast. Yeah, sure. So Child of God is now in our family. And the peculiar thing is, you know, that's our family name. That's my name. That's Stan's name, Child of God. We make different parts of it. That's why we're not the whole body. We're each members of the body or members of the family. That's why, as hosts, it's all of us, finally. It's not just Abram out there. And who is talking about that? Sarah scurrying around. Well, Abram's scurrying around, too. Yeah, that's true. It's the family. It's us. We. It's the church. We. Why there should be no contention in that place when you're... That's all of our names. That's who we are. We are the people of God. When I was a child, I thought my mother was crashingly beautiful. And I loved her with a deep romantic love, as some children do their mothers. I thought of her as somehow or other my queen. No, not as if I were king, but rather as if I were, I don't know, a prince. I don't know. My mother was so beautiful. I was born in 44, so if you can remember how people dressed at the end of the 40s and the beginning of the 50s, she had raven black hair, she did. And she had it, remember how they used to put that hair up?
Yeah,
so you could see the hairline. And she had this beautiful widow's peak. To me, it was, you know, I almost, it's like bird wings. It's like bird wings, this widow's peak, and she'd come around like that. She had a narrow nose and a pointy nose, just a little pointy nose. So then if you watch her while you're driving, if you just watch and stare at her, and she talks, you see that when she talks, that little nose just dipped down. Well, that to me was such a charming gesture, the dipping of her nose when she would use her upper lip. And when she cried, I always thought, you know, that pure tear was right there. I know better now. I've been to the seminary. It's not a tear, it's snot. But I loved her in those days. And in the evenings when she and Dad would go out, honestly, go out into the night, it always seemed to, I mean, that was romantic to me, that they would go into the mysterious and scented night. She would come into my room before she went. She would have put lipstick on her lips, bright red, and fingernail polish on her fingers, blood red. Do you remember that? So you have these beautiful contrasts. She would sit next to me on my bed, and the very weight of her sitting there would roll my... So then she's a woman of substance and beauty. I could feel her weight as she sat. And it's a little bit like entering into a person, you know, when you understand the weight and you roll against that person. Then you're leaning up against and she smelled so good. You know what my mom smelled best about were her leather gloves. I used to like to open up the drawer and smell the leather of their gloves. And that always was a mystery and romance at night that she would go out with gloves. And she would love me back. She would love me back. And one of the ways she would do it is that she would lean over and kiss me on my forehead. And call me Wally. Kiss me on my forehead. Call me Wally. And then she would disappear in the night. And I imagined such wonderful things she was doing. Dancing. Darkness. But if I got scared that she wasn't with me, and if I worried about her love, all I had to do was get up and go to the mirror. There it was. There was her love. There was that bright red smooch. I guess they worked to, so that that doesn't happen so much anymore. Is that right? Too bad. Too bad. Too bad.
It took all the joy out of lipstick.
And then in the morning, I would go downstairs, and it's a school day, and I'd come floating down the stairs. I'd hardly touch those steps. I just float down. I float into the kitchen, and there is my queen, with crushed slippers under her heels, standing, poking eggs, just poking eggs, very upset. My poor queen, she's very upset. She's really angry, but I come floating in. She's got her nightgown or whatever, house coat on or something. Her hair is no longer neat and back. It's like, ginger, how? That's her hair, shouting, how? You want to watch out for hair like that. And I would come close to her, and now her smell is not the leather gloves. And she's going like this to the floor. She says, Wally, where were you? This is not the same way to say Wally as the night before. Wally, where were you? And she said, and she would say things like this. She would say, if you're not ready in time, where are your clothes? If you're not ready in time, you go to school on your own. This is Grand Forks, North Dakota. You go to school on your own. And my mother never lied. She might exaggerate. She might use hyperbole. She might use metaphor. But once it's said, she's a German. She had to do it. My mother is the reason I'm a poet. If you think that I speak with a scorching tongue, she did too. She spoke in marvelous figures. I mean, they made me tremble. They were very effective. They were not just intellectual things. Oh yes, metaphor, this is like that. No. She says to me, you're going to walk to school, and that's what's going to happen. And now I go up those stairs just tremblingly. Gee, where are my clothes? And I promise you, I can remember this just burning in my mind. I could find all the clothes except one sock. And I heard the car start up outside, and everyone went off to school, and I can't find this sock. I'm in tears. I'm alien. I'm overwhelmed with guilt. I can't find this. And she comes home later. I still haven't found this sock. But I'm crying, and she knows where it is. I don't know how she always knew. It was between, we were in bunk beds, and here is the post of the foot of the bed, and here's the wall, and it was right between the foot of the bed and the wall. Oh, I didn't know how to feel, except my mother says, you're walking to school, which is over a mile or something like that. It's Emmanuel Lutheran School, and I'm going to walk there. And you know, she's not going to say, here's a note, Wally was sick. No, she writes a note. My mother writes a note and says, Wally couldn't find his sock. To the woman of the evening. This was a difficulty for me. It was a conundrum I could not, what my mother used to do to me. And I would feel so terribly guilty, and I would try to find the cause of it. And you understand, if there are no deeds to make the cause, then you become the thing. You become the guilt. I didn't know how to handle that. In the evening, I had such love, and it was absolutely unquestioned. And I loved her back. But in the morning, and at other parts of the day, when she became frustrated, well, you know what? In the third grade, our teacher told a story, and that story shaped me. That story literally shaped for me things that I could not understand. This is the story. And please, people, I'm going to repeat this over and over. We often talk about metaphors and metaphors of God, and we reduce that language to something intellectual. We reduce it to illustration. But the potency and the power of language is that metaphors are not illustration. You pack up bag and baggage and you move in, and that's where you're living. So I heard this story, and this is what it said. It said there was a queen years and years ago. Once upon a time, there was a queen married to the king, and she was beautiful. But she had a sorrow in that she didn't have a child. And one night in the winter, she was sitting, and it must have been an open window. She was sitting at the casement of a window sewing. And as she sewed, she pricked her finger, and the blood fell into that pile of snow that was on the sill. And the sill itself was made out of ebony wood. And she sighed, and she prayed, oh God, give me a child. Let her have hair as black as ebony, and lips as red as this blood, and skin as white as snow. I'm there. This is not metaphor. I'm dwelling there. I understand, and it understands me. God listened to the prayer of this beautiful woman and gave her a child whom she loved to distraction, but she died. And after a while, the king married another woman who was also beautiful, but this woman did a thing which was just horrifying to me, but I understood it. She talked to herself, and herself answered. She asked herself questions, and herself answered the questions back. This sort of solipsistic existence, solus ipsis, this interning existence. She looked at the mirror, and she said, mirror, mirror on the wall, looking at her own image, who's the fairest of her all? Think about all that. Looking at her image, she's asking her image to tell her who's fairest. And of course, she's looking at the image, which is looking at her. It's, woo! Think about, Luther's word in purgitas, in saying, turning into oneself. But I understood that, and the mirror said over and over again, you are fair queen, the fairest. And her face said back to her, yeah? Well, what do you look in the mirror for? Who is the fairest of? And it never quite answers, right? Good thing, be happy. Don't be angry. Because there came a time as this child grew up and developed hair as dark as ebony and lips as red as blood and a face as white as snow that the mirror answered her and said, no, Schneewittchen, Snow White, she is the most beautiful. Her! Now this woman is angry and there's a whole sense of guilt just goes shooting out from her. A sense of alienation and you know the rest of the story. For me, this was salvation. Now, children, what I'm telling you is not aberrational. You must understand this. This is what stories do for children. Read Bruno Bettelheim's The Uses of Enchantment and whatever else Bruno did right around the mark. Grimm's fairy tales walked with children through crises that they could not walk through on their own. When I heard that story, I understood. Even though there's a part of me that knew that I was dwelling in something I would finally have to leave one day, I had two mothers. I had the mother of the evening, which was that first one, who sighed for the love of her child, and it was true. But every night it was as if that mother died, and the next morning I got the mother who saw in me, in my beauty, the woman of the night. Now I am not guilty, I understand, she's jealous. And I feel pity for the mother of the morning. I really, truly did. She's jealous of that relationship that the mother of the night has with me. And I'm not guilty anymore. I just remind her of things that make her uncomfortable. This is shaping. This is shaping. This is shaping. When the story actually takes real events and arranges them in such a way that they finally give comfort, make meaning, save. The oldest meaning for the word poet, you know that poietes from Greek means the maker, and the Renaissance poets really loved that because they used to think of themselves as literally making something new, which goes back to what I said before. But you know that the oldest cognate understanding of that word poet literally means this, and this is what I am. Ready? The poet is a heaper into heaps and a piler into piles. That's what it means. That's what it means. And what it means in effect is the poet comes upon human experience when it's just exploded or when somebody dropped it like pickup sticks. And when the poet sings, you understand, and when the poet sings the details that are before her again, puts those, and when the poet sings, it affects experienced people. It's not just, please, oh, for heaven's sakes, don't force our old ways of Sunday school upon art. You don't read the poem to say, what is this teaching me? No, the poem is read to you so that you can experience it. What do you think is happening in this community right now when Mark sits down to the organ and the piano and plays? You don't say, what is it teaching me? You release yourself. You allow this thing to shape your day. Look, shop. This is the old English word for poet. And it really is the core or the source of our present word shape. Shop in the 7th, 8th, 9th century. The shop was one who always was a part of the comitatus. The lord and lady living in a meat hall with a relatively small area often had the singer with them. And the lord and lady were called the ring givers, or the hovard. I should talk to you about that word, lord. I'll just say this real quickly to you. In Old English, it was two words, hof and where. This talks about relationship. In Old English, they spell like this, hof and where. So H-L-A-F and W-E-A-R-D. It means the keeper, the ward, the keeper of the loaf, bread. That's what it meant. It was the keeper of the bread. The idea being that there were some of those, we're talking about the organization, this morning Fred was talking about the organization of community, that part of the organization of community is that there are some who distributed the welfare, who distributed the food to all, and that there had to be some trust between the distributor and those who received. And so Clawford, as time went on, you drop the H, it became Lavard, like this finally. The F becomes a V, and I'm jumping several steps to go through this. It becomes Lavard, so you said Lavard, and ultimately then the AV was lost and it became Lord. But in the back is the one who gives forth the bread. That one always had the minstrel, the shop, the singer. And if I could just sketch for you a day, I don't even have time for a day. Well, pretend I just told you about a war. And pretend that I just told you how in that war, one of our dearest friends died. One of our dearest friends, Gertrude. No, she's really dear, but she's here. Someone with Helen. Troy Helen. I don't know. One of our friends died in a horrible thing. And we all went back to the mead hall and we ate at the banquet. We ate at the banquet. This has to do with the whole issue. I mean, it's around the issue of hospitality. And when we ate, we also drank that mead. We drank, we'll just put a little buzz. That's always helpful, you know. A little buzz when you're suffering the loss of somebody. And while you're sitting there, doggone, doesn't that minstrel, that shot, get up and strike a chord? Okay, now this is Mark. Or it's me, it's us at a funeral, for example. Strike a chord, and it's an immediately familiar chord. And he starts playing the song everybody knows, and they all nod. Yeah, and they're even humming, deep voices, high voices. They're all humming that familiar song. The Lord's my shepherd, I'll not... Well, we all know it. We sang it when life was good, when we were young, and when it declared the sweet order and the meaning of our universe. Well, he makes me down to lie, okay? So we all sing that, nodding, slowly, sad. But then Mark, and then he starts singing new verses. And in that new verse pops up Helen's name. And in the verse actually come the details of that day. But it still is the order and the sound and the rhythm that we know, which declares unto our full heart, no, but there is order in the world, and yes, there is meaning. And the whole reverential quality of the relationship between God and us is accessed. Terrible language. But there it is, and we're experiencing it. And then as you continue to sing and Helen's name comes up, we're all saying, yes, yes, and we're crying. But now we're seeing Helen now, not in a death which is meaningless and useless. We're seeing, we're feeling, we're recognizing, we're experiencing how her death fits in the order of things. So the shop is shaping the day. And now we cry. This you do at funerals. Of course you do eulogies. I was told you shouldn't. Yes, you do. You speak a good word of the one who died. And make sure you're speaking real words and everyone can remember the details. But you know, as you tell this immediate story of that one's death, you weave it into the old, old story. And all you're doing is telling that old, familiar story again with new names, so that when you come to the end of that, when you move through the business of the dying and the rising again, all of a sudden Helen now is embraced, and now we're saying yes, yes to something much larger than our grief. That's what the shop did. We still do it. Shape the day. And you know afterwards, if you get to those people and you said unto those people, please tell me what happened on that day, what they're going to tell you. Now listen, all ye among you, European, Western European thinking people. What they're going to tell you is not what necessarily happened factually, but what it meant. And that will be their history. And you tell me, are they right or are they wrong? I say they're right. Because it's upon that revised, that reshaped history that they can continue to live and shape themselves. It becomes the truth. Of course, in our present day right now, and I understand that we get very uncomfortable with reshaping, and we try to go back and find the actual absolute fact. The trouble being, of course, is, I mean, this is an old, old argument, and I'm just being silly using it, but when we go back, we also still bring all of our presumptions, and we're reshaping things anyway. Now you understand what I'm talking about. Songs at the banquet, songs of sorrow, the ordering of experience that makes the day. The prophets did this. Yesterday, Fred was talking about how the Jews could continue to live when they went into exile. You know that they were torn from their belly button? You know they were torn from the thing that said who they were and why they were and that God was with them? They were torn from the temple and its cultus. They were torn from that. When they went into exile, several things kept them a people. When the northern kingdom went into exile, they're lost. Of course, the Assyrians did exile a little different from the Babylonians. The Assyrians literally scattered them throughout many kingdoms. The Babylonians did allow the Jews a certain place south of Babylon, a certain place, which helped. Nevertheless, they could have been lost. You know that death in the Old Testament is not just physical. The death of a people is what happens when they scatter. Scatter is death. Gather is life. Scatter is death. They could have been lost. But several things worked in their favor. One is, all of a sudden, Sabbath became very, very important. It was something they could do without a temple. So also very important became Torah. So also became very important at this point, circumcision, to make them and name them a people. But one other thing we should not overlook, and I'm about to teach many of you something new. Everything I just said, please keep it in your mind. But the prophets told the news of the day. The prophets literally told the story of what was happening. And by the telling of that story, they shaped it, and they shaped the people in such a way that where the people might have thought they were lost, they weren't. Jeremiah says unto them that even Nebuchadnezzar is a servant. God says, I take Nebuchadnezzar, my servant. Look what's happening here now. As Jeremiah tells it and tells the story, all of a sudden God is in charge of everything. Now, another people in those days, you must understand, please, another people, not just those days, but for millennia, when they were beaten by a stronger people, generally went over to that person's God. Because, of course, this is a better God. Our God couldn't save us. That God saved them. We'll worship that God. That's how people got lost. Well, one of the ways did Jews hold on to their God was because Jeremiah told the story of what was happening. You have turned away from God. And we've said this over and over, we prophets. And because you have turned away from God, now God is punishing you. That sounds like a horrible word. And we get very uncomfortable with this punishment that God does in the Old Testament. Dear people, it is a hopeful word. Now we can say all that is bad which is happening to us does not sever us from God. It is at the hand of God. And then the same fellow, the same Jeremiah, talks about a remnant. I mean, there always is that potential of hope. Because they could read their days as punishment and a recognition of their sin, which drove them also to Torah. The days were shaped. Their whole lives were shaped. Their history in the very moment was shaped so that there might be both God and hope. Same thing with Isaiah. Same thing with Isaiah, who suddenly, or you know, Isaiah 40, pops up. Whoever this prophet is, pops up and looks around and sees Cyrus is doing things. And immediately interprets it and gives the news. I'm saying it that way because almost anyone who gives the news is shaping it. And we have to make a choice of whether we're accepting their shaping and interpretation. I don't trust the facts. I have to talk to Bruce about that. The facts in court. I just don't trust the facts. Well, he knows that. That's why we have... Anyway, I'm off. They shape the news. And so Isaiah sees Cyrus moving around like that, and immediately God through Isaiah, I'm thinking particularly in the 45th chapter, says, Cyrus, I am anointing you. And I'm doing it so that my people may go home. Now the very future is... So what the prophets are is the presence of God. What the prophets are is the presence of the Word of God. What the prophets do is allow the Word of God to shape what's going on. Because God in the Old Testament is present not visually. God is present orally. Thus spake the Lord, is the declaration of the presence of God. What other way, dear people, do we have to make God present better than to tell the stories? I'm skipping. But we have a story. And it must be told. And when you tell it, you have the freedom. Sometimes you must tell it according to Holy Scripture so that we don't allow that thing to slide into other hands or away. We always return to that telling in Scripture. But you tell that narrative in such, just the way the shops did, just the way the prophets did. I told the story in my parish over and over. And I said, see, this is where you are in there. You tell that story. This, I talked to several people beforehand, in Deuteronomy 5, 2 to 4, there's a remarkable understanding of what the telling of story or what ritual action does. Moses is saying unto the people, who now are the second generation, they really were not at Horeb. When you stood at that holy mountain, you, Moses says, and not your ancestors, when you stood, God gave you this law and you saw God face to face. In the Hebrew, there's a liturgical sequence to that. There's a rhythmic repetition, which means that that phrase was used down the centuries, and we figured out where it was used. On Pentecost, on the Jewish 50 days after the Passover, when they began to reread the law. Here's the understanding, catch it quick. that when liturgical or ritual language takes place, particularly when it tells the story of our past, time collapses. And so everyone who repeated those phrases of Moses in the succeeding generations was saying unto you, doesn't matter the year that you live in, time collapses. You were at that holy mountain. You, not your ancestors, you. And that's not just to make it personal. I mean, it's not just to say this embraces you, but it is to say, now let me tell you the story and you are there. I know we're discomfortable with some of the Catholic understanding of the Mass and so forth, but I will submit to you that every time we tell the story again and enact the banquet and are received by the host, time collapses. And we are at the cross again, and we are at the resurrection again, and nothing divides us. And this is not an illustration. This is not an intellectual gesture. This is holy and spiritual fact. We are there. So tell the story. I'm thinking of the whole liturgical year. Advent, Christmas, Epiphany. Oh, I would like to have time and show you how this drama unfolds. And it does it so beautifully that you scarcely even know it Sunday after Sunday what's happening. But when the church remembers this, we're gathering you up. We're gathering you up like children in our arms. And our arms are not our arms at all. It's the story. It's the story that holds you. And in that story, you begin to feel what your shape is and your name and your purpose as that year gets told. All the way through from Epiphany and then into Lent, where this hero of ours goes to work and fights death and the devil. And then the Holy Week, which is the climax of this tragic play. And then Easter, which turns it around and we experience it time after time. Let me tell you a story. Do you mind?
No.
Does anyone have to go?
No.
Feel free. I want to tell you a story about my father. This is relatively recent. And the question above this story is, what was he doing? What was my dad doing? My parents live in Colorado, and by an accident, Fan and I were going to be out there for a meeting near Colorado Springs. They live in Canyon City, south of it. But we got a call just before we went off from my sister, Dina, who said, Dad's in the hospital in Colorado Springs, and don't worry about it. They're going to put a pacemaker in. And they're going to put the pacemaker in on Thursday. He went into the hospital Wednesday. It was Ash Wednesday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I see the hand of God in these things, and I see the story of God unfold. We got there. We didn't intend to be there. But when we got there on Thursday, Than and I, and we went into the hospital room where Mom and he were there, we discovered some serious news. On Wednesday, they tried to put a catheter into his heart, you know, to check out how they would do this, and they ran smack into a valve, which is so calcified they couldn't get by it. So instead of just a pacemaker, they're going to do open-heart surgery Thursday, Friday, and they're going to take that valve out, and they're going to put a new valve in. Friday, in the hospital on Ash Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, he went in, and it was a horrible surgery. When they got to that valve, it as they say, I don't understand the story, but they said it exploded and sent tiny little bits and pieces actually into his bloodstream, which began to throw off clots. And without talking to us, my brother Mike felt horrible about this, without talking to us, they did a bypass. They did several bypasses, which meant his surgery lasted for 7 hours, which is really about as long as you can go under the anesthetic without incurring some grave danger. Now, I was about to leave for England. It was when the Book of God came out, and I was going to England to get interviewed and all that stuff, you know, BBC and so forth. And I asked my brothers and sisters, what do you think? Should I go? And they said, yes. Dad came out of that surgery doing this. I wish he would. You know, always... Mm-hmm. Well, I shouldn't reveal my politics. He'd always do that. You know, A-okay. But he couldn't talk. And so the very first day we thought things were well, and they said, go on. So I went to England. I wish I could tell you that Thursday night was the first time I remember where I completely did the devotions, and I read what I wanted to read, and Dad offered one text, and it was the text of baptism. We die with the Lord Jesus Christ that we might also rise. We are drowned so that we may also rise. He chose that. I chose Psalm 139. Always with the Lord, yea, even when I wake, I am with thee. Anyway, so I went to England. And Fan called me almost straight away and said, Wally, it's not good. His kidneys were failing. And so he was on dialysis, and he was swelling up huge and purple. Other things were failing as well. But wait, she said, we'll let you know if you have to come. He was unconscious. Conscious, I mean, he would make noise. You know how people will do that, just like I do. So I kept thinking about my father when I was in England, answering some stupid questions about the Book of God. Just stupid. I'll tell you about it someday. Well, they when it came out, they read the, what do they call it, the naughty bits.
Yeah.
They read David and Bathsheba. They didn't read on, you know, to the worst sin of killing Uriah. And they, and so in the London newspapers, a tabloid paper, it said, the Book of God, bodice-ripping Bible. Stories you never heard in Sunday school. So I'm asked, what do you think of this? And I said, gee, these are stories everyone heard in Sunday school. What do you think? And I'm thinking of my father, and I'm remembering how he used to tell us stories all the time. And I'm remembering how when he retired, he got all of us out in Colorado, and he stood on the mountain. This is my image. He stood above us in his cotton work shirt and jeans, and his white hair was blowing with the wind. He looked ancestral already. Mm-hmm. And he said, I'm giving you all, grandchildren and children, I'm giving you the only thing I can be you, he said. He said, that is faith. I give you faith. Keep the faith. I remember that. I remember. And so I'm thinking about that in England. And then finally, Than calls and she says, you better come home. My brother Mike remembers that Dad had written a letter that said he did not want to be kept alive by extraordinary means, and he's getting very upset because he thinks that's exactly what they're doing. So I flew home. I flew straight up into the hospital, and I got in the hospital on a Sunday night. My mother was in there, and my father, they were aspirating his lungs, and it sounded like he was groaning. He was so gone. He was so hollow at this point. And Mom is sitting, and she's doing two things. Mom is, as you know, the strong-willed person. On the one hand, she's indicating how it's okay because it seemed like he talked to us today. And on the other hand, she's upset with this guy who's aspirating, and you're not doing it right. You're not doing it right. She had a reputation, you may imagine, in intensive care unit, ICU. But, I mean, she did it all with the smiles, but nobody got around her. We talked that night and we went home and I couldn't sleep and I came back the next morning at 4 a.m. and Dad was bleeding into all of this apparatus. And they were scurrying around. They did not know where the blood was coming from. And they said to me, please, would you call your mother? I called my mother and I said, Mom, Dad is alive, but he's bleeding. Maybe you want to come now. And I remember sitting in Dad's little cubby and looking through the whole room where the door is to ICU, and there my mother stood. I'd never seen her so small and wilted. She wouldn't walk in. She just stood in the doorway like this. And I knew she was thinking that if she'd come, maybe Dad was dead. So I went out and I took her. I didn't want her to see all the blood that they were cleaning. I walked her into another room and I said, he's not dead. Now that's one of the few times that I remember that Mom actually needed me to be strong for her. But they did begin, the blood began to wane. They never did figure out what it was. And then I watched what my mother was doing with my father. Dad, she said, coming in the morning. Dad, of course he's out. Dad, I'm looking forward to the time when we can sit on the, they have a cabin along the Arkansas River, when we can sit on the porch cabin and look out at the Arkansas River and wave to the train. I'm looking forward to that time. And then she stops as if a new thought struck her. And she turns to him and she said, oh, or did you want to go to heaven? Another time she came in and she looked at him, looked like he was in pain, and she took my father's hand and she was just rubbing and squeezing the hand. She said, Dad, squeeze me if it hurts. She said, see, it hurts. And my brother Mike came and we had long conversations. He was just torn up. He said, we shouldn't be doing this. We should pull these plugs. Dad didn't want. I said, Mike, we don't know what Dad is doing. It may be that we're giving Mom time. Dad has given Mom time to adjust to what may happen at the end. Maybe it's a slow death for that reason itself. And right now, I promise you, Mike, I know from experience, Dad is not suffering this. We are, not Dad. And I don't know what Dad is doing. I kept repeating that over and over again. Don't know what he's doing, but I remember the last night I was there before I had to go back, I spent all that night with my dad. I was holding his hand, and I was talking and talking, and I was promising promises I never made before, but I remember them. I was promising promises about the gospel and the faith and what I was going to carry on doing. And I thought he wasn't hearing anything at all. And finally, I'd been standing so long, my legs were getting tired. And I put his hand down. I said, "Dad, I'm going to sit for a while." And I went back and sat, and doggone, there was, boom, that hand was up there. It was looking. It was, you know, the baby, right? You know the baby is reaching. And so I came, and I blew my chair up, and I took that hand, and I sat with him all the rest of the night. And I went home. It was about 10 days before Easter. It was the week before Holy Week that my sister Debbie called and said, "You know, it looks like Dad's talking." He whispered to me. "Did he really?" I said. "Yeah." And I, not my wisdom, I just know Dad. I said, "Debbie, if he wakes up, he's going to preach on Easter." He is. Once before he called me when he wasn't preaching on Easter, and he said, "Wally, I'm dying." And that wasn't a metaphor. His life was that every year since graduation, he would preach the gospel on Easter. I said, "He's going to want to preach." I knew he had a text. He always thinks in advance. She called me up 6-7 days later in the middle of the week. She said, "He's ready to. Yes, he's going to preach." I said, "Get the people there. Get Mike there. Make sure he's there. Bring that tape recorder. I want to hear what he says." What was my father doing? This is so crucial. When he preached, they put pillows behind him, and he spoke in just this raspy whisper. I heard it. I can hear it on the tape still. He said, "On Ash Wednesday, I prayed that I might share the sufferings of my Lord. On Ash Wednesday, I prayed that I might share the sufferings of my Lord." And then he laughed. He said, "I didn't think he'd give me the whole load." Listen to me. What was my father doing? He was living in the story. He was living this liturgical year, and for him it was absolutely appropriate that he would go into the hospital on Ash Wednesday, and that during Lent he would be down under the ground in the darkness, and that come Easter he would be up and speaking again. And in his mind there was no issue about what does this mean. There was no issue about what does death mean. There was no issue about should I be afraid of the pain and the suffering and the death, because he had said that he was baptized into the death of Jesus Christ that he might also rise with Jesus. This is what I'm talking about when I say that our liturgical year is not just something to be sneezed at. It is the retelling, the diurnal, the annual retelling of that story over and over again. It is the gathering of the children. My father in that darkness felt at least the arms of Jesus. That was his person and his being and his name. Sing the songs. Don't ever lose what some other of our brothers and sisters have done. The clear retelling of this story. And if in your church it doesn't happen, grab your grandchildren and sit down and say, "I want to tell you a true story. There was this little baby born to a woman named Mary. And that baby's name was Jesus. For he shall save his people." That's you, my child, from their sins. Thank you.